Marlon Graves, the bus dispatcher, and Mamie Yarbrough, the school board member. "We don't swim," Yarbrough asserted. "We don't run to the water. That's in our history. When people wanted to get black people, they'd drown them." "They'd put you in a crocker sack and put bricks in the bottom," Graves added. "There aren't a lot of black people who can swim. My parents told us to keep away from the water, that it was too much to drink." Yarbrough laughed at the memory. "They say Eric's death was an accident," Graves offered. "That's what they say," Yarbrough said. "We know Eric McGinnis didn't go to the water on his own. We know that." "That's what we believe," Graves agreed, "that somebody held him down and drowned him. They'll come forward. They won't be able to live with it." I heard this a lot in my conversations with adults from Benton Harbor. Black people don't go to water. Especially, they'd stress, rivers. At first, it struck me as both farcical and sad. Here, blacks were repeating the same stereotypes uttered by those on the other side of the river. Who can forget Al Campanis, general manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers, who remarked on national television that blacks lacked the natural buoyancy to swim well? Why give credence to such nonsense? Why this myth that blacks viewed rivers as unfriendly, if not the enemy? And why suggest that Eric, who was fit and could, according to his mother, swim, wouldn't attempt just about anything, including crossing the river to flee the St. Joseph cops? A little history might help. The river, that is the boundary between the communities, forged the character of the two towns. Benton Harbor for many years boasted the nation's largest outdoor fruit market, and the land along the river became both towns' most valuable real estate. In summer, St. Joseph and St. Joseph Township host over 800 boats moored at the four marinas, and freighters still ply the river, dropping off their loads at one of two cement plants near the waterway's mouth. The St. Joseph River carved these two communities. But for African Americans, the St. Joseph and other rivers have taken on a more confusing role. The St. Joseph River was a final crossing for fugitive slaves. In the small town of Cassopolis, 33 miles southeast of the Twin Cities, a band of Quakers harbored runaways whose last barrier to freedom was the St. Joseph, which they would cross under cover of nightfall. Some continued their flight into Canada, but a large number settled there, creating what became the largest concentration of black farmers outside the South. There are also accounts that an ardent abolitionist in Benton Harbor housed fugitive slaves who, after crossing the St. Joseph, could enter his home through an underground passage leading to the river's edge. For fugitive slaves, a river was a friend and a foe. In escape after escape, they waded the rocky beds of streams and rivers so that the pursuing hound dogs couldn't pick up their scent. The river, particularly under the cover of darkness, was also a navigational tool, a natural trail that guided fugitive slaves through deep brush and woods. But what was perhaps most notable, rivers like the St. Joseph marked, metaphorically and literally, the last leap to liberty. It was the final obstacle. Crossing the River Jordan came to mean completing the run north. But for much of this century, rivers served an unambiguous role, particularly in the South. Rather than the source of life, they became its extinguisher. Lynched bodies, weighed down by cement blocks or chains, were deposited in rivers throughout the Deep South. Emmett Till's mangled body, a bullet in his head, an eye gouged out, and his forehead crushed in on one side, was found in the Tallahatchie River when the barbed wire holding the cotton gin fan around his neck became snagged on a tangled river root. 9 years later, when the civil rights workers Mickey Schwerner, James Chaney, and Andrew Goodman turned up missing near Philadelphia, Mississippi, FBI agents and 200 sailors scoured the surrounding waterways, and though they didn't find the three activists, the bodies were eventually discovered buried in an earthen dam, they did find the bodies of other blacks long missing. I mention this history because I think it helps explain why people felt so certain that Eric did not voluntarily enter the St. Joseph River. Maybe he fell in, but swim it? To get home? No way. Memories of Klan rallies and tales of lynching remain vivid and to this day seep into the routine of everyday life. But there were other reasons to believe that Eric did not try to swim the river, as the state police had suggested. The St. Joseph is not easy to swim, particularly the closer you get to its mouth. Winds out of the west blow lake water into the river, and that creates a sloshing effect, not unlike the result of plopping into a bathtub. It also creates powerful undertows. The winds push the surface water upstream while the river itself is gently pushing downstream toward the lake. On gusty days, the river appears to flow the wrong way, upstream, producing swells between the piers that can reach 12 to 15 feet, capable of upending small craft. Once, a combination of waves and ice tore the foghorn off the lighthouse. On May 17, 1991, the day Eric entered these waters, a stiff breeze blew in from the northwest, generating 2-foot waves in the lake and stirring up the river at its mouth. It had rained off and on all day, and the temperature had hovered in the 50s. By the time Eric might have made it to the river's edge, it had dipped into the 40s. The water itself was a frigid 49 degrees, cold enough that the Coast Guardsmen wore flotation survival suits, wetsuits to guard against hypothermia in case they fell in. Most swimmers, without protection in such cold waters, would cramp up within 10 minutes. It was an unlikely night for anyone, even a panicked teen, to enter the river voluntarily. Moreover, Eric was not an experienced swimmer. One of his friends said that when Eric was at the beach, he would wade up to his knees and no farther. Another said he and Eric used to hang out together at the YMCA pool, in the shallow end. His mother, though, says that Eric could swim. My sense is that Eric could manage in deep water, but wasn't an especially powerful or savvy swimmer. I don't believe that Eric would have looked out over the St. Joseph River, contemplated the 350-foot crossing, and thought to himself, "No problem." The sight of the choppy waters at night would have been intimidating to him, as they would to the strongest of swimmers. What's more, entering the river is no easy matter. The steel pilings create a sheer drop into the water. There is no sandy beach or gentle sloping bank. Then there's the question of Eric's untied shoes and open pants, as well as his missing overcoat. According to Eric's friends, he often wore his shoelaces untied. It was the fashion, a cultivated nonchalance. But his friends were equally adamant that Eric did not wear his belt unbuckled and hanging loose, nor did he cavort around with his pants open. So what could have happened to cause his pants to become undone? David Smith, a retired Coast Guard commander, who now works as a water safety consultant, often testifies in cases involving drowning incidents. I ran by him what I knew. Most people who die in the water do so within 10 feet of safety, Smith noted. Their big problem is getting back out of the water. Usually they don't try to take their clothes off, but try to get back to where they came from. If someone slips off a dock, his primary move would be to get back to the dock. Fishermen who fall in try to disrobe because their boat has blown away. Smith theorizes that Eric was in a situation similar to that of a fisherman. Getting out of the water was not an immediate option. Eric, he suggests, could not exit the river. A person who tries to take his clothes off usually realizes that he has to swim somewhere and that safety is not near at hand. Eric did not drown immediately because he tried to undo his clothing. And the indication would be that he wasn't near safety. For example, if he'd fallen off a nearby bridge or if someone pushed him in and he had to move away from where they were. What Smith suggests, without saying as much, is that Eric probably did not choose to enter the water. If he had, given the water's iciness and his waterlogged shoes and jeans, he would have tried almost immediately to clamber back out. If he had gone in at the Arboretum, he would have had trouble pulling himself up over the breakwall or, in the dark, finding the safety ladders built into the wall. But that's how he would have drowned, desperately clawing his way out. It would not even have occurred to him to try to disrobe. And the missing coat? If Eric had tried to swim the river, he first would have hidden his coat along the shoreline, as was suggested by the state police profilers. But it was never found. If Eric had gone in the water involuntarily, he probably would have had it on. And if that was the case, it would have been the first item he ripped off. It's conceivable that it sank, and to this day, remains submerged. These weren't the only open questions about Eric's death. The body. The dead man, a 55-year-old Taiwanese immigrant, whom I'll call Li Ying, looked dignified even under the fluorescent light and against the stainless steel of the autopsy table. He was a suspected suicide. The day before, a group of factory workers eating lunch under the summer sun had spotted a body floating in the Kalamazoo River. Police officers fished it out, identified the man from a prescription for pain medication he carried in his pants pocket, and tracked down his wife, who had just found the suicide note. Writing in Chinese, Li Ying had apologized for disgracing her and begged her not to disclose to family or friends that he had taken his own life. He wrote that he still had extreme discomfort from his recent gallbladder operation and despaired at having been laid off from his job as a cook. His employer had told him he was too weak to perform his work. The police speculated that Li Ying, who according to his wife couldn't swim, walked into the mild currents of the Kalamazoo until he could no longer retain his footing and drowned. His body was brought to what the pathologists and police obliquely refer to as Ward 20, a euphemism used on the hospital's paging system. There are no wards 1 through 19. Ward 20, the morgue, is located in the labyrinthine basement of the Grand Rapids Blodgett Memorial Medical Center. It is here, on one of the two steel beds, that Dr. Stephen D. Cole, Deputy Chief Medical Examiner — the Chief Medical Examiner is the director of the County Public Health Department and does not perform autopsies — cuts and slices bodies, some of which have already been cut or sliced, in the hope that he will be able to tell loved ones and the police precisely why the person died. Cole is a forensic pathologist, part doctor, part biologist, part sleuth, and part anthropologist. He is well respected by his peers. In his 14 years at Blodgett, he has performed 4,000 autopsies and did another 1,000 when he was a resident in Houston. He's so good that law enforcement officials from 35 Michigan counties have at one time or another sent him bodies to examine or, in some cases, re-examine. Berrien County is one of his more regular clients. It frequently ships bodies the 80 miles north to Grand Rapids. In 1 year alone, Benton Harbor police sent him a half a dozen corpses, all suspected homicide victims. I had a standing request with Cole to view the autopsy of a drowning victim. Drowning is a diagnosis of exclusion. In concluding that a person died from drowning, a forensic pathologist wants to rule out all other possibilities, including heart attack, poisoning, a blow to the head, strangulation, stabbing, shooting, and any other means of assault. Cole is, by his own admission, compulsive and obsessive. He is fiercely focused on his work. 44 years old, of medium build and height, he appears disheveled and perpetually preoccupied, his shoulders hunched, almost touching his ears, his black hair uncombed, his mind so focused on the minutiae of his work that every week his secretary makes 2 copies of his weekly schedule, one for his desk and the other for his refrigerator at home. When I asked Jim Reeves whether he'd do anything differently regarding Eric's death, he answered tersely, "I should have sent the body to Cole." Eric's body had been examined by Dr. E. Arthur Robertson, one of 3 pathologists at St. Joseph's Mercy Memorial Medical Center. Each serves a week in rotation as the county's medical examiner. None is a forensic pathologist. None has spent the requisite extra year of training or taken the boards in forensic pathology. Before his arrival in St. Joseph in 1982, Robertson had been a pathologist at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. He is a tall, angular-featured man who appears so narrow and elongated that one almost suspects he could walk upright between prison cell bars. Robertson tells me that nearly half of all suspected homicides are sent to Cole, who, he readily admits, is better trained for such cases. Robertson also adds that suspected murder victims can be unusually time-consuming, to say nothing of controversial. "What was your most controversial?" I ask him. "The Mabin shooting," he says without hesitation. He remembers that the body was brought to the morgue late in the day, and prosecutors, local cops, and state police crime experts hovered around, demanding that Robertson perform the autopsy immediately. He did. He examined the 2 bullet holes, exit and entrance wounds, and concluded that the bullet had entered through the chest and, in a downward trajectory consistent with someone's having shot from a second-floor window, exited the lower back. Just to be certain he wasn't missing anything, he excised the 2 wounds, preserved them in formaldehyde, and sent them along to Cole for a second opinion. Cole, he told me, couldn't come up with anything definitive after examining the 2 bullet holes. But I got a very different story from Cole. Mabin had not been shot in the chest. He had been shot in the back. Despite the fact that Cole performs over 200 autopsies a year, and that it was 4 years since he had examined Mabin's wounds, he remembered the case quite well. He rifled through his files and took out slides of the wound, which he projected on a wall in a conference room adjacent to Ward 20. The sample from the lower back is a square-inch piece of skin in the middle of which is a nearly perfectly symmetrical opening, as if someone had carefully pushed a pen through soft tissue. That is typical of an entrance wound. The bullet carves out a neat round hole. The other sample, taken from the chest wound, is irregular in shape, almost like an oval tent flap. That is typical of an exit wound, after the bullet has been slowed and redirected by the body's tangle of organs. The entrance wound, Cole concluded, was in Mabin's back, not his breast. Cole speculated that Mabin had been leaning over when Fiedler shot him, and the bullet had entered his lower back and exited his chest. Cole knew that the shooting had caused strain between St. Joseph and Benton Harbor, and he didn't want to register his opinion without double-checking his findings. He consulted Dr. Vince DiMeo, the chief medical examiner of Bexar County in Texas, and the author of a book on gunshot wounds. DiMeo confirmed Cole's judgment. Cole remembers calling Wiley, the Berrien County prosecutor, who, on hearing of the possibly botched autopsy, said, "Oh, shoot." Cole also sent a letter to the prosecutor outlining his discovery, though the language hedged a bit since Cole says he hadn't seen the full body and since formalin can cause tissue to shrink slightly, sometimes distorting samples. He wrote that it was impossible to definitively state which wound was the entry and which the exit. Nonetheless, Cole told me that he was 90% certain that, contrary to Robertson's conjecture, Mabin had been shot in the back. Wiley never disclosed this, nor was it mentioned at Fiedler's trial, though, to be fair, Cole seems more certain of his findings now than he did then. And to this day, people in both Benton Harbor and St. Joseph believe that Marv Fiedler shot Norris Mabin in the chest. If Eric's body had been sent to Cole, would it have made a difference? When Robertson received Eric's body and heard that the deceased may have been last seen in St. Joseph, he knew right away that this had the potential to be a high-profile case. Robertson, with Detective Dennis Socek observing, dissected the body. He took x-rays, looking for bullet fragments and broken bones. And he withdrew urine and blood samples for testing. The autopsy report is just over a half page long. Cole's report on Li Ying ran to 8 pages, including a critical discovery made 3 weeks after the actual dissection. While microscopically examining slides of liver sections, Cole noticed evidence of inflammation. Further tests revealed that Li Ying had had hepatitis C, which could have accounted for the man's unusual tiredness and pains. When I showed the report to Cole, he diplomatically replied, "It's cursory. Others I have showed it to were not so restrained." Bob Kirshner, the former deputy chief medical examiner for Illinois' Cook County, and now the Physicians for Human Rights lead forensic investigator on human rights abuses, said of the report, "This does not meet the standards of a forensic autopsy. He, Robertson, shouldn't have been doing this case. He's not qualified to do this kind of autopsy. He should have said no." At a minimum, Kirshner told me, the postmortem should have included an examination of the tongue for bite marks, which might have indicated that Eric had been struck in the mouth or on the head, as well as a thorough exam of the neck to rule out strangulation. Finding bruises or lacerations on a decomposed body can be like looking for juice stains on a Jackson Pollock painting. During decomposition, red blood cells break down, changing the skin color to a purplish blue, obscuring bruises. And so, Kirshner told me, one must make incisions through the skin into the fatty subcutaneous tissue to see whether there has been any hemorrhaging. This procedure isn't mentioned in Robertson's report on Eric's autopsy. Nonetheless, Robertson concluded that there were no obvious injuries. The cause of death listed on Eric's death certificate is accidental. Said Paul Ciolino, a private investigator based in Chicago with whom I shared the report, "It's homicide 101. You get a forensic pathologist." Of course, the authorities didn't feel they had a homicide. Another theory. Flaubert once wrote that a critic is a failed artist. So it might be said that I spend my energy puncturing the theory that Eric tried to swim the river because I failed to produce evidence that something else had occurred. But then there's Daniel Thornton. Thornton, a convicted burglar, provided Reeves with the only proof, however tenuous, that Eric may have been murdered. 2 years after Eric's death, Reeves was on to other matters, including a $78 theft from the local McDonald's by a teenage employee. On occasion, though, he received tips. Usually, they led nowhere. In August 1993, Reeves received a phone call from Abbott Taylor, a deputy sheriff. Taylor had been approached by an inmate at the county jail who maintained that he knew what had happened to Eric. The inmate, Daniel Thornton, offered to exchange the information for leniency in his sentencing on charges of stealing $695 worth of jewelry and CDs from a house trailer. A few days later, Reeves drove the 2 blocks to the county jail. Thornton claimed to have witnessed a white teenage boy berate Eric for dancing with a white girl. Thornton said the boy chased Eric down to the river, where he pushed him into the frigid waters. The story, like Thornton himself, was a bit off kilter. But as with all the tips he received, Reeves felt obliged to pursue it. Besides, Thornton mentioned a young man, whom I'll call James, who had come up earlier in the investigation.